Welcome back to the UConn Honors Podcast. My name is Mukund Desibatla, and I'm a double major in physiology, neurobiology, and Spanish. We're excited to welcome you back to our concluding episode of The Volume. And here's my co-host, Vinayak, and he'll let you know about that.
Hello, guys. This is Vinayak Mishra. I'm currently majoring in molecular and cell biology with a minor in Spanish. We're super excited that this is our final podcast, but it's also kind of a bittersweet ending here as we have our final guest today.
Yes, we have Saurabh Kumar, who is a university scholar, and he is actually looking at a project on fetal onset hydrocephalus. So Saurabh, could you introduce yourself and let us know a little bit about this university scholar project?
Yeah, sure. My name is Saurabh. I am currently a senior on the molecular and cell biology track, minoring in statistics. I'm from North Andover, Massachusetts, so out of state. But yeah, I've found a nice home here at UConn. Fetal onset hydrocephalus, you know, not many people hear about this, but basically what you can imagine is if you ever look at a cross-section of the brain or an MRI or any image like that, you'll notice that there's two large cavities in the center of the brain that are filled with fluid. So those are called the ventricles, right? For a variety of reasons, either due to genetic causes, developmental abnormalities, or infection, you know, that ventricle can grow very large and therefore compress the brain and then cause the actual, you know, skull and the brain size to be very large. So if you, a lot of times this disease shows up before a baby is even born. It's very concerning. And one of the major problems with fetal onset hydrocephalus is that, you know, we don't really have a great treatment for it. The current treatment centers around shunting the brain. So shunting means to actually go in and implant a catheter into the ventricle to just constantly or a drain fluid at some rate out of the ventricle and maybe down all the way into the abdominal cavity. So problems are that, number one, it's a highly invasive procedure. Yeah. We're doing it on patients, you know, a couple of weeks after they're born, because that's when the abnormalities show up. Problem number three is that if we look at children who have been shunted with hydrocephalus, children who haven't been shunted with hydrocephalus, the proportion of children who develop cognitive issues is more or less the same. So although it's a cosmetic fix, it's not really, you know, going to the heart of the problem. They're not fixing the developmental, the actual, you know, cognitive issues that's going on.
That's a really interesting research that you've become involved in. And from what I understand, there is a very, quantitative and computational side to this. And I believe that was definitely a challenge that you came across. So how did you overcome that challenge and essentially incorporate that aspect into your project?
Yeah. The projects are unique in the sense that, what we're thinking is that if the ventricle is enlarged, the actual surface area increases. And so we're thinking, you know, stem cells during development actually are driven more towards producing the cells that line the ventricle called ependymal cells. And therefore, we're not able to produce as many neurons, leading to this cognitive deficit. So this kind of new hypothesis is not many people are looking into it in this developmental neurobiology field, but I've really been able to, you know, get involved in this field because I've had, like, honestly, so many great mentors in different fields. My PI, Dr. Joanne Conover in the P&B department, tends to look at all these neurobiology issues from multiple perspectives, and so she brought up this idea of, like, maybe we should look at volume and surface area changes through MRI scans. And so with that, I've been able to work with people like Dr. Tom Peters in the CSE department. And so to work on, you know, developing preliminary models of, you know, surface area expansion, volumetric expansion, also bringing that back, I've also been able to, you know, take the data that we produce from, you know, mathematical expansion and histological changes in cells from our lab and bring it to our collaborating neurosurgeon at Yale University, Dr. Chris Calley, to give his final, like, you know, clinical input. So just I been fortunate to have so many great mentors with different backgrounds that are willing to work together to, you know, tackle this issue from a new way that hasn't really been looked at quite so seriously before.
Yeah, and that's super interesting how you've been be able to be super involved in this project and also have these amazing mentors to help you out kind of throughout the way. Where did you kind of get started into this project? Because you are so far ahead now and you're a senior. Where did you kind of begin and what kind of drove you to go in this direction of studying this fetal onset hydrocephalus?
Yeah, so if you really want to start from the beginning, I think I've always had an interest in the field of central nervous system injury because my father has suffered from a neurological disease that caused injury to his spine. And so ever since, you know, middle school, when he experienced that, I've always been fascinated by this. You know, I was told, like, from the first time we learned learned about nerves and whatnot, that neurons can't regrow. So, but, you know, the neurons in the central nervous system can't regrow, but the question is why. And so that kind of drove me to look at some of the researchers at UConn who have been involved in this idea of regeneration and you know, central nervous system issues. And so I ended up finding Dr. Conover, who was looking at this idea of fetal onset hydrocephalus. And so, I mean, we can conceptualize this too as, like, you know, damage is going on in the brain, right, in a lot of cases in these infants from a young age. And so how is it going to impact them? Mm-hmm. And is the current treatment out there, right, you know, how can we modify it to best suit the needs of the children and the families that, right, have been involved? So,
and also, like you said, it is only, like, the current fixes are only kind of cosmetic fixes, and you kind of want to look more into trying to fix the overall, like, developmental issues that also come up with this problem, correct?
Yeah. So I wouldn't say it's not purely cosmetic, but it does have a lot of issues associated with it, I think. Mm-hmm. One of the last statistics I saw is that shunts have about a 40% failure rate in 1 year and 50% within 2 years. So usually these infants require a lot of revisions to their actual shunt surgery. And let's say, you know, things do go well, shunt's working fine, this child's going to grow, and then you're going to need, you know, I imagine, you know, longer catheter tube, right, and everything. So it's not the ideal treatment in any sense. You know, elective brain surgery is not something, you know, we want to have. Yeah, so just bringing light to that.
Right, and it's really sad news that shunting is not the best therapeutic intervention for this disease. And I think it's really amazing that you've been able to wrap around this topic and find a project that will look into potentially new sources of therapeutic intervention. And I guess I wanted to touch a little more into the application process for University Scholar, because this is really different from previous research experiences that you've had, such as you've done SURF, you've applied to numerous scholarships and grants, and I think that's all, like, really amazing experience that built up to this. But at least, how did all of that feed into pursuing the University Scholar laureate?
Yeah, so well, you know, these kind of big things, these big scholarships and grants don't come out of nowhere. You know, somebody either shows by example or, you know, suggests you to, you know, apply for these things. And so for me, I remember when I was a freshman and just joined the Conover Lab that I think it was three of the seniors when I was a freshman were actually university scholars in the lab. And so I ended up hearing a lot about it from them. I remember I actually attended the end of the year, like, I think it occurs in April or May, workshop or information session for prospective university scholars that year. I think I was actually only a freshman then, but it's attended for sophomores. So I went that year. I went the year after a little bit more seriously to learn about the process. But I learned about it and I heard about how it's the ideal, in a way, the, you know, ideal university scholar is looking at something kind of from an interdisciplinary perspective, and that too, you know, really deeply. And so over time, as I started to get more involved in some of the modeling from MRI data and also looking at, you know, the cellular characteristics, I realized, you know, this might be a really good university scholar project. And I talked to a lot of different advisors that I mentioned before to see, you know, if they'd support me in the project and, you know, what their thoughts were on that. And so, yeah, it just didn't start from just thin air. You know, right. There are a lot of people who helped me, influence me.
And of course, you had a ton of previous research experience to kind of drive your research project and eventually apply from this interdisciplinary perspective. What were like some of the hindrances that you faced while you were either through the application process or you faced now kind of taking on the project itself?
Yeah. So I think anybody who's involved in research of any sort will know that, you know, nothing ever works the first time or frankly for the first 20 times.
Right.
One thing that I learned is that you can have an intention, your goals can be set in advance of what you want to accomplish, but the actual pace at which you'll achieve success is drastically different. So, I mean, I think in retrospect, I might have written a project that entails, you know, years of work, whereas I only had 3 semesters to carry this out. So I think that we could call that a hindrance. Another thing that has kind of, you know, been problematic is, you know, because the university scholar program requires, you know, at least 3 advisors on your committee, you know, it's been important to, you know, communicate with, you know, all 3 of them, make sure they're, you know, on the same page as far as, you know, approving my plan of study and the actual research project. And because eventually all 3 of them will have to read and approve my final thesis. So I think those are some of the big things. But I think, to be honest, because I was fortunate to have a PI that pushed me to apply for, you know, these other opportunities beforehand, a lot of like the real questions of, you know, can I really do this? Am I really like, you know, qualified for this? Were kind of fleshed out with the application I did like right before that. So, really thankful for my mentors.
Yeah, and I think that's amazing that you were able to at least like find a culminating project to your final few semesters not just a P&B major, but also as just a student that's really, really interested in research that wraps around the central nervous system, the disorders and such. And I think that's really amazing that you were able to just look out and find different mentors than the ones that you spent the last few years with. And that was definitely very challenging. And I think at least through this process, I like how you put it, it doesn't come from just thin air. There is definitely a build up to it. And it's amazing. UConn does offer information sessions for university scholars, for anyone that's interested in applying. And it's definitely, I think, definitely beneficial to attend those. So I wanted to push towards an open-ended question that we usually like to ask, which is, how has this experience, especially pertaining to university scholars, helped you grow as a leader?
Right. Because you did have other experiences such as like the SURF grant and various other grants and scholarships and fellowships that you've applied for. So how did this kind of idea grant differ from your previous experiences and like really enrich you?
Yeah, I think over time, I don't see this as the final thing so much as like, you know, just the next step in like a continuation of you know, different things that have helped build me up into who I am right now. But I think just over time, just realizing that I didn't want to just take what a superior, you know, grad student or PI just told me to do just, you know, at face value. You know, I wanted to understand, you know, how does this happen? You know, really understand, you know, what are the drawbacks, limitations, benefits of doing something a specific way, and even, you know, propose my own ideas of, you know, how to go about doing it. I think I started to, you know, develop this, you know, critical thinking kind of characteristics, you know, over time, especially like through like lab meetings that we would have, you know, we'd throw out data, but and then, you know, a lot of times we would, you know, sit there in a circle and, you know, question it, you know, like, are we sure that this is like what we're seeing, or is it, you know, just like an artifact of the process or whatever we're doing. So I think everything so far has kind of helped build this curiosity and this like learning how to ask the right questions, which I'm not nowhere close to perfect on right now, but you know, I've gotten a lot better at it over the years. I think that's really helped, just, you know, being engaged and trying to learn more.
I think your experience has definitely offered you a different perspective on research. You have not seen it in this way where it is you really question what is the validity of this data, mm-hmm. and how does this apply to the purpose, what I'm seeking.
Yeah.
So I think that's really amazing. And I wanted to also ask you, do you have any advice that you would offer our listeners who are interested in not just the University Scholar Program, but research in general? Like, what do you encourage mm-hmm. that individuals do to approach this often burdensome process? But it's not really that tough if I guess you look into the resources that UConn offers, and I mm-hmm. think you are definitely exemplary as a student that was able to.
Thanks.
So yeah, what advice would you give?
Yeah, I think the number one most important thing, I think this works for, you know, whatever field, anything you're interested in, is just to be curious. You know, try and learn different things. I think everybody who comes to this university has access to so many different resources. You know, it's such a large university with, you know, lots of resources and excellent research faculty and everything. And so I think if you're curious and you want to learn about something or you know, just be involved with something, I think just reach out. There are so many, you know, faculty members, graduate students that want to help. And I think that just getting, you know, past that first step of, you know, like, of just, you know, finding somebody who wants to support you can go such a long way. I've had great mentors, you know, grad students. I'm repeating myself over and over, but yeah, it's just being curious. I think finding great mentors is another huge thing, because you don't know, like, their support will take you so far. You can have, like my PI, Dr. Conover, has encouraged me to apply for all these great opportunities, and, you know, I'm not looking back. And the, I guess, number three, if is to remember that, you know, although, you know, somebody is supporting you, you have to remember that they have their own opinions, they have their own way of looking at things, and it's great to seek out the advice of as many people as you can. And so you don't get, you know, stuck looking at something just one way. You know, go look at the actual sources. If you're talking about research, that means, you know, like, actually going ahead and, like, critically, like, looking at the actual research papers that have been put out on that topic, once you can, you know, understand the major concepts. And so, you know, I think those are my three main points. You know, to always be curious, find people to support you, but, you know, remember that that's just one opinion out there. Mm-hmm.
I think it's super, I'm super, like, excited that you said that, you mentioned, like, mentors, because I do think that they still play such a large role.
Oh, for sure.
In kind of helping us develop our own interests, but also because of the experiences that they've been through, they've been, like, in the position that you were mm-hmm. once, right? And so that they know what comes next and how to help you build your own, like, perspective on things.
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of similar to what has happened to you from your freshman year to now you're a senior, where you, even though you're still driving your own project, you still kind of have these, like, really large mentors who've played such a large role in coming up with this project and mm-hmm. now are helping you get through it. So that's definitely super important.
I absolutely agree. And I think you offered amazing advice for any listeners, any students that are interested in research. Yeah. And I think the most important thing is, I like how you put it, stay curious. And also UConn offers the resources to be
there
able
so
to...
many different things, yeah.
Right. And there's so many, like, University Scholar is not the only, it's not the only opportunity to be able to materialize an idea that you really want to investigate outside of the classroom.
Yeah, totally. So I want to emphasize that, you know, although I've been fortunate to find all these opportunities, and you build up, you know, my scientific background beforehand. You know, a lot of university scholars, you know, that might they apply to the program as, you know, like one of their first experiences. You know, it's not, the university scholar program is not at all limited to the sciences at all. In fact, the director, Monica, mentions that, you know, a lot of people in the sciences tend to be selected because we tend to hear more about the actual literature and what's going on in the field from an earlier point. So I think as long as you are curious, you want to learn about whatever field you are in, the humanities, arts, whatnot, as long as you try to learn about it earlier on, you're basically at the same point as anybody else. So
of course.
Yeah.
I agree. And I think the students that are really interested in these opportunities will definitely have the resources provided here at UConn. So again, I wanted to thank you so much, Saurabh, for being able to come here and share your story.
Right.
And
thanks,
I think,
for inviting me.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think if anyone wants to get in touch with Saurabh about either the University Scholar or his specific project, we will put his contact details
That'd
below.
Be great. Mm-hmm.
So with that, we will conclude this volume, Agents of Change, which has really been a journey for both of us. Vinayak, I think we have definitely been able to feature 12 really diverse but immersive interviews. And
yep.
With that, I think we will definitely let you all know about our future updates. Please stay subscribed to us, because we really want to put together another volume and share it with all of you.
Yeah, we will definitely be coming out with another volume focusing on we're not really sure.
We'll put it together, and I think hopefully we'll at one point be able to feature faculty leaders as well.
Leaders,
and
right.
I think it would be very interesting to draw a parallel. But for right now, please enjoy. If you haven't seen the other interviews, there are 11 other interviews attached to the season. So please take the time, get to know these individuals. And again, we have the contact information available on whus.org. Right. So with that, thank you
so
again.
Much.
We're your co-hosts, and this was Agents of Change.